Tune to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our end-of-year drive. Help us meet our $70,000 fundraising goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO by entering 44321 and text the word KBOO. Our members continue to support community radio every time they give.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Support your independent community radio station, KBOO. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, or you can text KBOO to 44321. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to steward and harvest the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for this place of refuge. I'm going to begin this month by reading a selection from Quarreling with God, a compilation of poems from the Sufi dervishes of Turkey, compiled and translated by Jennifer Ferraro and Latif Bolat, which is available from White Cloud Press in Ashland. There's a very long tradition of Sufi poetry coming out of Turkey and surrounding regions. Very little of it has been translated into English, so I'm really happy to have this book and to be able to share it with you. First poem I'm going to read is by a 15th century poet who went by the name Nesimi, and it's titled, What of It? I myself took up the cloak of blame. I smashed the bottle of honor and virtue on a stone. What of it? Sometimes I rise up and watch the universe from above. Sometimes I go down to earth and lose myself in love. What of it? Sometimes I study life's meaning in the holy books. Sometimes I go to the tavern and get drunk. What of it? Sometimes I enter my garden to pick roses for my darling. I grew those roses and I gathered them. What of it? The wine of this love is a sin, the Orthodox think. The sin is mine. I fill my glass and drink. What of it? The pious bow to the niche in the mosque. I bow at the beloved's doorstep, pressing my face up close. What of it? My enemy says loving beauty is sinful. I love my beloved, so I'll gladly pay that price. What of it? They ask Nasimi, are you and your beloved getting along? Whether we get along or not, my beloved is mine. What of it? And then the second poem I'd like to read is by Aksaraise Ibrahim Effendi, who lived in the 17th century. It's titled The Sufi Way. It's quite a lengthy poem, so I'm going to read most of it. They say the Sufi way is to give one's life away. The Sufi way is to become a sultan on the throne of the soul. In the station of the path, it is to destroy appearances. In the station of reality, it is to become a guest in the innermost palace of the heart. They say it is to be pure of body, the light of the beloved. The Sufi way is to gradually take off the dress of earth and water. They say it is to burn up in love's fire. The Sufi way is to be utterly inflamed with the light of the beloved. They say it is to believe and follow the rules. The Sufi way is to discover the rules of the multitude of heavens. They say it is to destroy the illusion of bodies. The Sufi way is to open the secrets of the body with the key of the divine names. O Sufi, to comprehend it, one must be it. The one who gets lost in words will never be their meaning. They say it is to be in wonder at the greatness of creation. The Sufi way is to be constantly amazed by the nature of reality. They say it is to make each heart the throne of God. The Sufi way is to remove all else but God from the heart's dwelling. They say it is to watch over all humanity. The Sufi way is to cover east and west with every breath. They say it is to be in harmony with every kind of person. The Sufi way is to appear in 100,000 forms daily. They say it is to be like Solomon to the whole universe. The Sufi way is to understand and speak in every language. They say it is to become an ocean from a single drop. The Sufi way is to make your heart a cellar to hold the wine of the truth. They say it is to become a human being illuminated with the light of being. The Sufi way is to destroy being utterly in the light of non-being. They say it is to surrender your soul to the beloved. The Sufi way is to become the soul of the beloved. They say it is the proof of Muhammad's message. The Sufi way, O Ibrahim, is to embody God as one's own self. And those are poems from Quarreling with God, Mystic Rebel Poems of the Dervishes of Turkey. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I am your host, Teal Ansari. This will be my final episode of Wider Window Poetry. I've had this show for 4 years and it has been a wild ride. You think a few minutes about everything that's happened in these last 4 years. I've hugely enjoyed working on this show. It's been a lifetime for me through times of isolation, and I've met a lot of great poets, read a lot of great poetry, but it's time to move on. So this December episode will be my last, and it gives me great pleasure to finish up this show with the same guest who began it, Emmett Wheatfall. Emmett lives in Portland, Oregon, where he writes, records, publishes, and performs poetry. His collections include As Clean as a Bone, 2018, which was a finalist for both the Eric Hoffer Award and the Da Vinci Eye Award, Our Scarlet Blue Wounds, 2019, which critically examines American exceptionalism, and most recently, With Extreme Prejudice, Lest We Forget, earlier this year, a collection that recalls and examines the early days of COVID-19. Emmett has recorded several CDs of poetry, both with and without music, featuring some of Oregon's most gifted and talented jazz, blues, and gospel players, including the late and sorely miss Janice Scroggins. His latest release is Amazing Grace featuring LaRonda Steele, 2020. Emmett has performed lyrical and spoken word poetry in many Portland jazz venues, including the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall and Jimmy Mack's, once regarded as one of America's top 100 jazz clubs. Emmett also served on the nomination committee for the selection of several Oregon Poet Laureates, Peter Sears, Elizabeth Woody, Kim Stafford, and Anas Mojgani, who's currently serving his second term as laureate. Emmett was a featured poet at the 50th anniversary celebration of the March on Washington and was the keynote speaker at the screening of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech for the Oregon Historical Society's Oregon Black History Series program in 2013. He's also a long-serving member of the Milwaukee Poetry Committee, which hosts the Milwaukee Poetry Series and other great poetry events in Milwaukee. Welcome, Emmett.
Hey, Teal, how are you? Good to see you again. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm a little sad to be winding up the show, but it's time, so I'm moving on, and I'm happy to be also looking forward to new things.
Well, you know, you need to be commended. I tell you what you've offered to not only the poetry community of Portland's surrounding areas, but to the state. Your program has featured quite a few poets, and that's keeping poetry active and vibrant in our state and our community. And I want to thank you for inviting me today. I started out with your first show, which probably you learned a lot of things doing it for the first time, but now you're a consummate pro. So I'm glad to come back on the tail end. Congratulations, though, on your show.
Thank you. So I'd like to invite you to read maybe first from Scarlet Blue Wounds, and then we'll talk about those poems a little.
Sure. With all of our works, we're probably, you know, if you're a poet or writer, whatever, you're proud of your works. But I'm really proud of our Scarlet Blue Wounds. The publisher is Fernwood Press, an imprint of Barclay Press, and they've been so gracious to publish this collection. Maybe a little bit about our Scarlet Blue Wounds. It is a collection of different works. And it seems as if the last decade or so, we've been going through so much wounding of each other, sociologically, politically, and even emerging religiously, the divide, the words that are being said against each other, and the physical actions that are taking place. And we're really wounding our nation. And let me say real quickly, we all bleed red. Once we bleed and our blood reaches oxygen, it turns red. But our wounds are blue. Our wounds maybe are a little bit more visible on your complexion. But we all bleed red and we wound blue. So the signature poem for the book is called Our Scarlet Blue Wounds. It's an inclusive, our is inclusive, our. On the heels of something great, I'll take you there. Consider failure the cause celeb it is. Let's build a new world. Out of clay, let us hew a stone accent to spare. From 55-year-old timber, let us whittle a new age. Let love love whomever it loves. A resolution proffered by the bourgeois, is it necessary? We will secretly build new cities near rivers and deep within valleys. And in the times of fire and flood, we will lift like eagles to arias. Let us bleed red blood everywhere, bearing our scarlet blue wounds. Let love love whomever it loves. Should we mark every soul with a magic marker? Yes. Doing so before we return to the deaths that's prepared for us. May we, the old, die young, and you, the young, live forever. Might we agree to return here again? Let love love whomever it loves. I like that. Would you like me to read another poem from Our Scarlet Blue Wounds?
Yes, please.
Just let me know how many would like to read, and I can do that. There's a poem that's really special to me, and of all the probably hundreds to thousands of, and I'm not exaggerating, thousands of poems I've written, this one speaks volumes to me, and the poem is titled Boxed In. Boxed In. And in various segments of our society, it's on page 51, very segments of our society, we find people are boxed in life by certain margins and contextualizations. I love this poem, Boxed In. I saw a man with no teeth. He smiled at me. I bumped into a woman who had no feet. She crawled to me. I hugged a child with no arms. We laughed until I cried. A blind man called to me. Why couldn't I see where he was calling from? A homeless man cursed at me. Afterward, he and I shared his beer. I love this one. A streetwalker propositioned me. I replied, thank you, but no thank you. Then named the street after her. Some Americans are boxed in. Some people are like me. Some are like them. A poem titled Boxed In. There's something profound about that. There's a profundity about it. What else would be really nice to share with you folks today? I think this poem is rather lengthy, but I think I could read it in such a way that it doesn't eat up too much time. The poem is called White Walker. White Walker. And if anybody's ever watched the wildly popular series Game of Thrones, anybody remember, old enough to remember the old Jason the Argonauts, where the skeletons were, you know, attacking them and stuff like that? Well, similarly, the White Walkers in Game of Thrones was a threat to the people. And I wanted to use that as a metaphor, something analogous to something I feel really strong about. So it's really not about race, but it's about White Walker. It's on page 80 of Our Scarlet Blue Wounds. I remember being a gun-toting youngster. Holstered on my right hip was a silver six-shooter, reminiscent of Roy Rogers and Dale Evans' era of the Old West. All the boys in the neighborhood owned a six-shooter. Fortunately, it could not shoot real bullets, even though we pretended it could. It was a good thing, too, for us youngsters could not afford the bullets. Gathering weekday mornings at the usual rallying point, we would pick sides. Shirts and skins differentiated us. As you can imagine, the shirts were the good guys and the skins bad guys. To be politically incorrect, shirts were cowboys and the shirtless them Indians. My soul winces at such distinction, and my shame a lifetime to bear for such attribution. Looking back now, I loathe the killers we were because the Indians always lost the fight, including arguments afterwards as to who had been designated shot and killed first, often signified by, "Ah, I got you." As if immoral miscreants, we would then count the number of dead on both sides. Today, and to my amazement, I have never suffered post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. Unbeknown to us, we were being conditioned. Death begins in the imagination, actualized through the physical imitation. We youngsters took no thought as to taking our friend's life. What appears so evil and deceptive was the fact our friends would rise to live another day. Just like the White Walkers in the HBO series Game of Thrones, season 8, episode 3. Little did we know we were being groomed to be White Walkers. Imagine that, a little black boy like me, a White Walker, killing indiscriminately and without forethought. The miracle, the absence of blood and severed body parts. The permissibility of imagination can be pure evil sometimes, especially in the mind of adolescents, which once was true, but no more. I no longer play or possess a silver six-shooter. I own a couple of 9mm Glocks with clips holding the standard capacity of 15 rounds. I hardly ever touch them and never run around my neighborhood with friends shooting at them. I am a realist now. Oh, how quickly back then I forgot about my first kill. It was a bird using a slingshot from my hand. We were being conditioned. The Vietnam War was going. You know, that was a young man playing. We're so conditioned today for certain things. And I think that poem really speaks to that. I no longer value the taking of life, even in a play or an imaginary way. So, I walk.
Yeah, so the phrase, the scarlet blue wounds, which you spoke about a little bit before, it recurs in several of the poems. So it's not only the title poem as well as the title of the book, but it's sort of a phrase throughout the collection. Would you like to read us a couple of the poems that feature that phrase so we get some of the breadth of it?
Oh, I'm not sure if I'm prepared to identify those. Do you have some in mind that struck you? I apologize, I didn't isolate those. I'm not sure exactly where I might have put some of them. I tried to sprinkle, I learned that from William Stafford. I believe he said, a great poet or Oregon poet, that, you want a plumb line in your work. It's the stitch. Those particular people, Christian and Stitch, know that there's a certain pattern you use. So I learned to insert it, but I'm not sure where exactly. Are there poems in here you would love to hear me read? I'd be more than delighted to do that.
I would love to hear you read The Black Body.
Ah, okay. And do you see what page number that's on?
43.
43? Mm-hmm. Let me read that for you. And I think that that's an excellent choice. Ta-Nehisi Coates is probably one of the great, great black intellectuals today. And he talked about how in our country it seems permissible and acceptable to destroy or to kill the black body. And so that inspired me, that thought. The poem is titled The Black Body. An artistic form of Black beauty is to paint the body of Black men and women. Let the artist go about glorifying the Black body, whether on canvas or without. Why? In our America, with such impunity, the Black body continues to be destroyed. The intellectual Ta-Nehisi Coates, our James Baldwin, states, quote, in America, it is traditional to destroy the Black body. It is heritage, unquote. Therefore, let Black men and women, artists who paint Black men and women, be given to sanctifying Blackness. For the beauty of the Black body is Black strength. Less forgotten are our scarlet blue wounds. And, you know, James Baldwin was just, he was a predecessor to Ta-Nehisi Coates in my mind. And, you know, we do, as Black Americans or African Americans or however we want to be characterized, we do bear the wounds of hundreds of years of abuse in this country. And so the Black body is beautiful when it's contextualized properly, whether by artists or musicians or whatever, lyricists. So I really enjoy that poem. Thanks for asking for that to be read. Do you have another that you'd like to hear?
Yeah, so maybe a couple more on that theme. A Patriot's poem, which presents a little bit of a variation on that theme, and is quite short. And that's on page 37. And then maybe How Easily the White Professor Forgets on page 72.
Okay. This book is, this work kind of punches up a little bit. And I always try to use some degree of discretion because you don't want to be offensive, but you want people to hear you. A little bit about Patriot's poem. We just celebrated Veterans Day. My father served in Korea, two tours in Vietnam. He was grievously wounded in Vietnam, survived. I'm grateful for our veterans who serve our country and work to preserve our great democracy. That gives you and I and other poets the opportunity to speak poetically. A Patriot's poem. Darkness is deep down here. Our day would egress upward, deep. We kneel before our native flag. Oh, glory, stars and stripes. Bring to life our scarlet blue wounds. Oh, glory, stars and stripes. Bring to bear our bruises blue. When we look at our national flag, red, white, and blue, red for blood, blue for our votes. The white part, you can go a million different directions with the white part, but it is a part of our nation's heritage. The other poem you wanted me to read was on page 73, I think it was. Yeah. I remember being in school, high school, my senior year, and my history teacher was teaching our class, and I was one of maybe two, I don't recall, but I know there weren't very many, maybe two of us in the class, and when he was teaching Teal, he said, and colored people. And of course, Emmett Wefall with his big mouth, raised his head, what color were they? And he had an aha moment, how he used a nomenclature or linguistics that was really offensive. And I'm a high school student and I'm in class. I'm not saying that this poem here was from that situation, but I do know of a seminary professor that sparked this poem. It's called How Easily the White Professor Forgets. And there's an epigraph at the beginning of this poem, a small, small epigraph. The United States is an immigrant country. How easily we forget our own heritage. Anonymous. a Christian seminary professor. How easily the white professor forgets. Heritage represents a high tower. There's no room there for forget-me-nots. Not in these here United States, not among the 50 states. For we, the descendants of slaves, remember. We descendants remember our forebearers were united in common bond. Imagine hands shackled and feet chained, stripped naked, black bosoms bare and exposed genitalia, disembarked at inlets, shuffled to stockyards and taken stock of, to be made stock of, to be made to work cotton and tobacco fields under blazing southern sun, built barehanded the country's White House, forced to serve without liberty, never allowed to harbor thoughts of freedom, beaten into thinking as if three-fifths of a man, deemed the wildest of beasts. No, Professor, we forget not our heritage. No, Professor, you forgot the country's heritage. Tell everybody, we easily forget, but we won't. We slave descendants are reminded every day. Your history, it's in the realm of revisionist history. Read the statistic killer Columbus's journal. Slavery is the African story. Slavery is the Native American story. Slavery is the Chinese man's story. Slavery is this country's story. Slavery is the founding father's story. Slavery is your ancestor's story. Something we cannot let you, Professor, in a moment of absent-mindedness, easily forget. The United States is not only a country of immigrants, it's a country of dead slaves, a country of sons and daughters of slaves. And we will never easily forget our scarlet blue wound. You know, we talk about American exceptionalism, and I agree, I love my country. And I love being American. I'm grateful for being American. And we have done exceptional things, America, throughout history. But there are two sides to the coin. And if we're going to be honest, we talk about the things that we've done that are exceptional. But there are some things that we've done that have not been exceptional at all. And we must keep the context and the holistic nature of the history in one piece.
That's a very powerful address to privilege, I think is how I would characterize this poem. And it's interesting because, you know, the professor who's quoted in the epigraph, you know, maybe is kind of trying to do the right thing in sort of a clumsy and naive way to say, hey, you know, our ancestors mostly came here from somewhere else. You know, we shouldn't just take for granted that this is our country. But at the same time, by making that statement, feeling the need to make that statement, the professor is overlooking their own privilege of even being able to forget that.
You know, I think your comment is very insightful. Look, I'm worried about our nation right now because there seems to be a segment of our population that has begun to romanticize the revolution. America's revolution from England. And I try to tell people all the time that most people who romanticize revolution have never fired a gun, have never been stabbed with a bayonet, who's never been shed blood. And so I think we need to be conscious of the fact that these things came at great human cost. And while we celebrate the founding of our democracy and all the great things it's done, we're still working to perfect our union. And it's become more difficult of late. But let's tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And that's what I try to do, is I try to speak both positive, but then I do try to put my finger on those aspects that the professor wants to forget.
So there's one other specific poem from this book that I'd like to hear you read. And of course, if there are other ones that you want to read, I'm happy to hear those too. But I'd particularly like you to read Americana, which is on page 109. Okay. And then I have a question for you about that.
Okay. 109. I can tell you read my book. I'm honored. Americana. There is no market for me other than illiteracy. I write what blacks won't read. I create what whites won't read. Sadly, others are unaware of me. Thus, the state of my poetry finds there is no market for me. Therefore, my sense of Americana, my shelf life, myself, my very life, in terms of poetic residency, there's no market for me other than illiteracy. I would love to talk a little bit about this poem and you've picked it.
Go ahead. Tell us about this poem.
I'm a Black American poet in Oregon. And one of the things I know, I'm not making a blanket statement, but I would like to suggest that I wish more Black Americans would read. It's not that Black Americans don't, many do, but I'd like to see us read more. You know, we focus on music, we focus on the visual arts, but I would really like to see us read. It really saddened me. I went to see Maya Angelou before she died at the Arlene Schnitzer, I think it seats 2,700. And when I looked around, it was 2,700 people, but I saw very few Black Americans. And, you know, I really wish we would read more, but we really don't buy very many books. And then, you know, when we write, I'm afraid that not a lot of our work, even in poetry, is read. When I'm in workshops and different stuff around poetry, I very rarely hear workshop teachers and you know, talk about Black poets, but they're very fluent in white poets. And, you know, I find even what I write, sometimes that there's a reluctance to read what I write. And, you know, I worry sometimes because I think people think I'm going to talk about always about civil rights or violence or something like that. No, I write about everything. And then, you know, I go to poetry readings and stuff like that. I don't see hardly anybody that looks like me when I go to these things. Boy, you know, I think the market for my work is, you know, I go into bookstores and I see other Oregon poets on the bookshelf, you know, and I write and look for an opportunity to have my books, you know, on their shelf. And that's their prerogative. They don't have to, but a reluctance to even get that. You know, and I've been working at poetry now for a number of years, my friend, and I think that there's a quality to my poetry and my poetics. I do it in a number of different genres. And so I think illiteracy is a strong word. I'm not necessarily talking about being illiterate, but one of the things I hold dear and true is I read so I can be literate. But I don't want to be, but you know, if people don't read my work, then I don't have access to literacy. I don't think you always have to have an MFA or an advanced degree in English, you know. I think you can teach. I'm not paying $100,000 to get an MFA. At 65, I'm not paying that kind of money, you know. So I can burn the midnight oil and get that. So anyway, that's kind of like what that poem is talking about. I don't get the kind of residency, I believe, that I see my counterparts in poetry in Oregon get.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Emmett Wheatfall. And this is probably a really good place to put in a plug for a book titled African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song, and it's edited by Kevin Young. It's an anthology from Library of America, and you can get it anywhere. It's a great book. I highly recommend it, and I also highly recommend Emmett's work. His books, As Clean as a Bone, are Scarlet Blue Wounds, which we've just been hearing some of, and his most recent, With Extreme Prejudice, Lest We Forget. And I would love for you to read some poems from that book. But first, so I haven't read this book, so I'm not primed with great questions about specific poems in it.
Sure.
But I saw that it was sort of recapping a lot of what many of us experienced in the early part of the pandemic. And so I want to ask you, before you jump into reading from that book, you know, COVID really put the lid on in-person events for a long time, and many of our favorite poetry reading series were unable to meet in person, and there were no live music events for a long time. And that was a really hard thing for poets, musicians, anyone who considers themselves a performing artist. I'd like you to speak a little bit about how that played out locally in the poetry and music communities that you're plugged into.
Well, I think COVID, she was once in 100-year kind of event. And it really turned literally everything upside down, especially the arts. Our art form is an art form that is one that's oftentimes read in the head, sometimes spoken orally or read orally, or we read in front of people. And when we went into the lockdown mode, that really put a clamp on the ability to gather together and share poetry. It took us, about a year and a half for people to become proficient with Zoom and WebEx and Facebook Live and all that stuff. And so it really impacted poetry in a profound way. I think we're starting to come out of it now. There are more poetry readings, people are wearing masks. There are some of us who got out. I know I did. You know, I wore masks in certain settings. Sometimes I read with the mask on. Others did that, but there was a lot that was done on Zoom. And, you know, I think people had an opportunity to be reflective. My only concern, Tilly, is that I don't see everything that is written. I don't see where more poets wrote about being in the midst of the pandemic. And so all of us were writing, but I don't see a lot of published work. I may not be privy to a lot of it, but I just haven't come across it or I haven't heard it reading. So I decided to write about it. And the title of the work is called With Extreme Prejudice. Now, I always try to tell people, don't get confused. I'm not talking about race here because of the word prejudice. With Extreme Prejudice is a military term. And when an order is given to prosecute with extreme prejudice, it means that you have license to kill, to wipe out, to destroy. And I chose that title because that's exactly what COVID did. It's been prosecuting with extreme prejudice. It didn't care about your age, your ethnicity, your sexual orientation, none of that. It will take a name. Sadly, Teal, on yesterday, I talked to someone who's a retired elected official of Oregon. She said she's gotten COVID. I talked to another person that I was going to be at a poetry gathering this afternoon. She had to cancel because she got COVID. Found that out. And before I went to bed last night, two of my dearest friends emailed me and let me know that both of them had COVID. Four people had let me know in one day. So this work is titled With Extreme Prejudice, Lest We Forget. And I'm afraid we're forgetting. And there are poems in this book that I want poetically for us to go back and remember. And I called my wife this morning. She's with our daughters in San Francisco. They're having a girls get together and they're going to take in a play. And I called my wife and said, let's continue to be careful. I've talked to 4 people in one day who've just contracted. Thank you for allowing me to contextualize this work. I think you want to hear from this book. I would like to share a poem called Before the End of Day. It's on page 15. For those who may get the work, they'll know the reference. It's called Before the End of Day. Before the end of day comes, advancing the question, where have all the day birds gone? Moreover, where have all the victims of COVID-19 gone? More and more day birds flee to somewhere. More and more victims of COVID-19 descend somewhere, somewhere beyond the end of day. I wonder if someday I will make my way somewhere, somewhere beyond the end of day. More and more, I am sure I will go and never return. If anyone returns before I go, please let me know before the end of day. The reason why I think that poem is so apropos, those 4 people called me. Many of us are vaccinated, triple vaccinated. We're at a point now where you can contract it and it's almost like flu symptoms, sometimes severe, you recover. Back then, if you got it, there might be a chance you might not make it through the end of day. And so I'm hopeful for my friends who let me know that they've contracted, that they'd be all right. I would like to share a poem called For All We Lose on page 29. Page 29. A lot of these poems are shorter, but I love this poem. If there is a signature poem for this work, it's called For All We Lose. Even me just saying that right now, I just felt myself a sense of wanting to weep at all the people, young and old, who have passed, those who now live with life debilitating disabilities. The poem is called For All We Lose. COVID-19, for all we lose, never to come again. The lighthouse remains, the channels flow, and humanity will go on. Do you know why that speaks to me? It speaks to me because humanity has been like a lighthouse. If we're analogous to a lighthouse, we still exist, even though COVID is here and it's not as severe. There was a time when it was so dark, but humanity, in the midst of that, continued to go on. And when I say the channels flow, I look up and there's a college football game or pro basketball game or a soccer, the stadium. Today is filled with people who are yelling and screaming, and this virus is still there. The channels still flow. Humanity is going on. And it's a poem of hope. It's a poem of hope. I don't know why I'm getting excited about these poems. They're coming alive because I haven't read them in a while. Would you turn with me until to page 65? This poem, Sing Like Italy. Sing Like Italy. One of those beautiful moments of our humanity was in the midst of COVID, the early stages, when people couldn't come out, they couldn't go to restaurants and stuff to go to a grocery store. The streets were empty. People set in countries set aside certain times when they come out on their balcony or in their front yard and they bang on pots and pans just to let folk know. A poem titled Sing Like Italy. Teal spring is coming. Songbirds will return to trees. Smoke will rise from barbecue pits. Sunday school will welcome back children. Saturday markets will bustle with customers. So will songs sung about the Savior be sung by church choirs. Eventually, the vagabond will die. Seniors will rejoice in mercy that is grace. Some will visit the gravesite of the less fortunate. Sally will again hang washclothes on clotheslines. Sam will return to his rickety rocking chair. Sisters will sob in their mother's arms. Sons will hug their father. In the skyline rests our lives until our deliverance comes. Let us gaze unselfishly at essential workers and sing like Italy. Oh my goodness. And you know, we're there now. You know, all these things, you know, outside hanging washclothes and clotheslines, and you know, people return to rocking in their rocking chairs out on the porch with a friend. Lest we forget. Lest we forget. I want to share another poem with you, if I could, that it's a short poem. I think this poem is really special. And the backstory on it is a beautiful backstory on page 19. I admit I'm on Facebook. I don't use it as much, but I'm on Facebook, and great mistake. One day I got a friend request from somebody I didn't know. Her name is Britton Meyer. She lives in California. I've never met her personally. I've never had a FaceTime with her. But she wrote me through Facebook Messenger and said, "Hey, Emmett, have you heard the song Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah?" And she sent me a video clip of an ensemble of singers, because there are a lot of people who perform this, choirs and ensembles. But this blew me away. And I thought about it, and I wrote about it, and I named the poem after her, Britton Meyer. I wish just the two of us could sit on the edge of the earth, our legs and feet dangling freely, the sun setting on the distant horizon as that mesmerizing version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah plays in the background while we pray for peace on earth and goodwill to all humanity. I dream of this. Your friend, Emmett.
Thank you. That's very beautiful. You know, I think a lot of people were writing during the pandemic, but not everyone, that doesn't mean everyone was writing about the pandemic. For some people, I think it was too close, too immediate. And then with publication cycles, you know, you were writing these poems, obviously in 2020, probably many of them. And now the book has come out in 2022, so it takes some time, I think, for these things to publish. I think there were a lot more poems published, perhaps in journals and anthologies. It will take time for more books to appear, but it's certainly an event that has left its mark on the arts, and poetry certainly no exception to that.
Well said. I certainly agree with you wholeheartedly. We have a beautiful art form. I often say to you, and I've been saying it for more than 15 years, I said, poets are the secular prophets in our society. You might have heard me say this before. When we're no longer listening to our religious leaders, there's been a great moving away from religious faith. When our political leaders are divided, we have hundreds of different voices. Throughout history of humanity, poets have always been one. ones who've spoken in the midst of political and social calamity. And I think As Clean as a Bone, I think of Scarlet Blue Wounds, to some degree, with Extreme Prejudice We Forget, tries to speak in contemporary setting with reference to past and future. So I think what you said is well said, and I hope we can find more resonance in a society where there's great conflict between philosophy and religion and polity, social justice.
So I have two more questions for you. And the first one is, what advice would you have for a beginning poet, especially a poet of color, someone who's, you know, in the situation of being a racial minority? How do you go about finding audience? How do you create some success?
It sounds like you've asked me two questions, I mean, two parts to it. First off, what I would just stand on the top of a building and shout as loud as I can. You have to read. And you need to read anything and everything. Because what it does for you, it educates you. It informs you. And one of the key things it does is it creates vocabulary, which is essential in poetry. Because the English language oftentimes is limited. It's not limited. It's very wide. Other languages sometimes don't have multiple words for a particular thing. But read. Number two, write. And then thirdly, study the craft. You can never play for an orchestra if you don't know how to read the notes on the staff. It is easy to write a poem in form. It's easy to write a line and turn a line. It's easy to rhyme, but our art form is an art form. And if you want to have success and to even approach that lofty place of being great, the greats will scrutinize your work. The talented and gifted will scrutinize your work. I'll talk about success. I went into Sarah's Old Country Kitchen once, standing in the lobby before they remodeled it, and on the wall was a poem by Maya Angelou. And when I started to read the poem, most people would just read it and say, gee, you know, there's a rhyme, A-B, or A-B, you know, C-B, you know, that rhyme. I did scanning. I found out that there were 6 syllables in the first line, 8 syllables in the second line. She was using rhyme in the second and fourth line. So I knew that there was a structure other than just reading it. And that made the poem, I don't remember the name of it, but it made it very important. So that I hate to use the word preach, let me just say proclaim. And then the other thing, to find success, forget about finding success. I'm gonna be honest with you. I've been working on this for 15 years. I think that the work that I do is really good. But I have another little saying that I say too. I cannot speak for my poetry. It must speak for itself. I don't care how good I think it is. I don't care whether or not, you know, I care. Sometimes you said the publisher, I wish I had more publishers would publish this work. If that work doesn't speak to the reader, greatness, I think, in poetry sometimes, if you don't have an MFA or you're not some college professor or unless you had some kind of success like Amanda Gorman, First Lady of the United States, hears her, and she invites her to give an address in the presidential inaugural, and she's technically on her way in some regard to be the next Maya Angelou. And there are people across ethnic groups that don't have that had no love for poetry, never looked at it, but they can tell you Amanda Gorman's name. So where am I going with this? I'm just simply saying write, 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 write. Don't just get discouraged when periodicals, 98 to 99% of what you submit will get rejected. And if you happen to get published and you wind up being a finalist or your book cover is a finalist, do it for the love of the art. I don't do it to make money. I do it because I love the art. I guess one more thing. You heard on the street, you know, if you're a drug dealer, they always tell drug dealers you can't make money if you smoke your own product. You can't sell it if you smoke your own product. Smoke my product. I go back and read what I wrote and I improve on it. And I work at it till there's nothing else I can think of. So that was a rather long answer. I'm sorry.
You've been listening to Wider Window Poetry.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored.